And it's recording.
My name is Ann Wynn Barringer Rogg. I usually go by Ann Wynn Rogg, and my name, I'm always called Wynn. My family and I moved from New Canaan, Connecticut, up to New Milford back in 1941. My father was a lawyer, but he really had a bent toward agriculture, and he just felt that that was what he wanted to do. And I remember the spring day, going down by Gallows Hill Cemetery, down the little back road, over across the bridge, across the Still River, and into the field to the north of the road. And we had a picnic, and it was just lovely. And I remember my father saying, up there is that old brick house, and that's going to be our home. And I can see it. I can see that day as clearly as, you know, as I am sitting here. And it was 1941, and I was 4 years old, and I'm probably repeating myself, but. And we had a small, shoestring, you know, 9 cows, all different breeds. But, you know, we farmed, and I used to go out with my father a lot. I think I spent more time out in the outdoors with him than I did it, you know, in the house. And, I helped him with milking, and I can remember when I was 5 or 6, he taught me how to read the weather. We'd stand there by the north door and look up the valley. It was very hard to get weather back in those days because there was weather from Chicago, and if you listen late at night on the radio, you might pull through a stray signal, you know. So you really had to know how to tell weather, because farming is very dependent on it. And he would show me the cloud formations tell me about, you know, which way the wind blew and everything. So that was the beginning of it all. And I had a dog, Poochie, which we had come to us deathly ill, but we nursed it back to health. And he was my best buddy all those early years. And my father said, you can go any place on the farm, just take the dog along, you know.
And how many acres did you have?
We had 125 acres. It was part of an original grant of 3,000 acres given by the King of England to someone, I'm not exactly sure. I think it was the noble family. Mm-hmm. And it would have gone from the Brookfield town line and the Gallows Hill Cemetery north up to the public golf course and from mountain to mountain. That was about 3,000 square acres.
Right.
Acres. And so it diminished quite a bit. But we had mountain, and we had wonderful farmland, and across the road, night pastures and the river, and a very fascinating old sycamore tree down in the swamp. And my father took me there one day, and there was a hole in the side of it, and we both climbed in. And he was a 6-foot-plus man, but we both fit inside. And it was a magical experience because up in the top of the tree was a beehive, and you could smell the honey. But you were sitting on the humus on the ground, and you could smell that too. And those aromas have never left me either. It's a wonderful tree. It's still there, but it fell down a few years ago. It's over in the middle of the swamp, and it's all Weatnog land, and I'm sure nobody goes there. It's all kind of grown up, but it was a very special place when I was a child. It was, Chris, 1941 was before the war was ended, and there was practically no traffic on Route 7. My father was civil defense. If they needed to stop traffic, he would go out with a flag and stop traffic. We had to have curtains over our windows at nighttime. That was a little scary, you know.
I bet.
But that was the only way that the war affected us, you know. And
it didn't affect like food at all or whatever it was available?
Yes, we have stamps. You didn't have enough stamps for the sugar and butter and things that you needed. But mother was a very creative cook, and somehow she made it all work.
Was there a sense of community to help that? I mean, do you think?
No. We were pretty much, we were on the end of town, mm-hmm. and we had a couple of neighbors who were nice neighbors. It was Charles Ulrich up over across the road on the hill, and Mr. Baskey, he was a Polish gentleman, and he had a farm just north of us, and then Bill Russell. And that was kind of our world, and it was, my brother was born when I was 7, but I was pretty much, you know, out in the fields doing my thing, and rather solitary. So I loved school because there were children, you know, my age, and I, you know, could hardly wait to get on the school bus and go be social.
Where did you go to elementary school?
Main Street School.
Okay.
And was there for 6 years. Mrs. Florence Miller was the principal at that time, and Miss Kelly was my first grade teacher, very lovely woman. And I think she's gone now, but she lived to a ripe old age, and she was just a sweet person. So, and probably the highlight of that was each year at the end of school, we would have a bicycle parade around the green, and Clarence Wise, who was our one constable, would hold up traffic. So everybody got to decorate the spokes of their bicycle, and we rode the bicycles around the green and then had a picnic on the green with watermelon and soda pop and sandwiches, I guess. And it was, again, you know, when you're a kid, that's pretty exciting stuff. So,
how has the green changed since you were a kid?
A lot more traffic. It and buildings around the, you know, some of the old houses came down.
Yeah.
I can't tell you their names, but where Sloan's Pharmacy was, there were houses down to that corner. But it's, I think people in this town treasure that green, and they take good care of it. And the houses that remain are, by and large, lovely, you know, lovely homes. And of course, there's not enough parking. There never is, but for people coming through. And a lot more traffic. So, but when I got into high school, we went 7th and 8th grade to East Street School on the lower floor, and then when you got to high school, you went on the upper floor. And in those days, you had an hour off for lunch, and you could eat your lunch quickly if you wanted to, and then had privileges to walk downtown, something which does not happen today.
No.
And so you had just enough time to go down to Sloan's and get a ice cream cone or something on a nice day, and then walk back again. So that was a pleasant freedom that is unheard of today, you know.
And this is at the soda fountain that used to be.
Yeah, at Sloan's Pharmacy, which there were three brothers that ran it, and they were very nice to kids. They really were, and it, it was our pharmacy of choice, you know.
Yeah.
So, my father was a prosecutor for 1 or 2 years there in the courthouse, and I remember going to a couple of trials there. And,
where was the courthouse?
Well, the courthouse was the town hall.
Okay.
Upstairs, I think, in the what is now the room where they hold the regular meeting. It was just interesting to see some of the characters. And the state police would always come down to our house to have him sign warrants and things like that. So a little excitement.
Do you think it was at all a culture shock for your father? Because, I mean, New Canaan, it's much more...
But remember, New Canaan back in those days was very countrified,
yeah.
too. They lived... there is a spur track from Stanford going to New Canaan. They lived down at Talmadge Hill, which was like the first stop on the way to Stanford. And there were a couple of houses around there, but a lot of it was open fields, but my father just didn't care for the city, mm-hmm. and the hustle and the bustle and all of it. He said he had a friend from law school. They went to Cornell, and after they graduated law school, they went to New York City, and this young fellow had no money, and he slept on the subways. He slept on the subways for a year before he could finally get enough to, you know. It's, when you think about it, that's pretty tough.
Yeah.
And my father just really wanted to be out here. He he didn't do much with the law business until, you know, later on, but we had an office in our house, and he did real estate law, and he liked that. But then he went into the legislature.
Oh, did he really?
Oh, yeah, he was in the Connecticut legislature, and somewhere in the 50s. I just don't have the dates anymore.
That's fine.
But he was, I think, here for six 2-year sessions. And he was the minority leader in the Senate over there for one 2-year term, and I think the rest of the time he spent in the House. And he used to take me over there, and it was so much fun. We would skip school occasionally, and he now this is very interesting. Back in those days, there were four lady legislators and one lady senator, and all the rest were men. And there were spittoons going down, the house is tiered, and there were spittoons going all the way down, and smoke all over the place. And they didn't have that fancy office building. Everything got done in the cloakroom, the negotiating, the rest of it. So he would hand me over to one of the ladies, and so I could find the restroom and things like that. And so I roamed all over, and I'd come into the gallery and listen to some speeches. And every once in a while, my father would introduce me to the house, and I was supposed to stand up. And when I got older, I could go downtown and go shopping at G. Fox. But most of the time, I was just stayed with him at the in the house. And so that was, that was fun. And of course, my husband Oscar became a legislator over there as well many years later.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, Oscar was the state rep for New Milford and part of, all of Sherman and part of New Fairfield. And he served for 8 years. He really liked it. He said it was so interesting, and he said it was different from town politics because over at the house, after you might have a day battling issues back and forth, but at the end of the day, everybody would go out and have a drink and talk to each other, no matter which side of the fence they were on. He said local politics didn't quite work that way.
It was a little bit more vicious.
A little bit more vicious. So, anyway, that was... my life. I graduated in 55. I went to Cornell University and I was an English major there and graduated in 59.
Was he from New Milford? Or?
Oh, now, I don't know whether you want stories from...
Whatever you want to tell me.
Okay.
I'm willing to listen.
All right. Well,
let's just put it on hold for now because they're all going to come out.
Here
we go.
We, as students, we didn't have a great deal of entertainment, but there were the proms, junior prom, senior prom, once a year, and it was quite exciting, to dress up in a ball dress and go with somebody. And we always had real live bands. They didn't even have amplifiers back in those days, so it was seven or eight men playing on the stage. It was very nice. Anyway, I was 15, I went to the dance with a boy, not next door, but just up the valley a bit. His parents would take us, and there was a girl on our school bus who is from Germany, and she spoke a little differently, kids are mean sometimes. Anyway, nobody would sit with her on the bus, so I used to sit with her, and I didn't know her well, but at least she had some company. Well, anyway, and her name was Veronica. She was going to go to the prom too, and she was going to come with some other boy, but she ended up coming with Oscar because her other boyfriend was ill. So the four of us sat at a table, and we danced a few times and talked and took it all in. It was, streamers and tables with lovely tablecloths and everything. It was a lot of fun. So anyway, I went back home, and my boy next door's dad brought us home, and that was it. Well, about a week later, Oscar and Veronica and her real boyfriend came to the front door, and I invited them in, and Oscar had brought his photograph album from Germany and wanted me to see it, and we chatted for a while, and then he said, would you like to go to the New Year's Eve dance at the German Club in Danbury? And I said, I think it would be fun, but I don't think there's any chance of me going because my parents, you know, they were very conservative. But I said, you could ask. So Oscar went over and asked my mother, and she said no. And I said, well, I didn't expect anything different. But about half an hour later, she came over and she said, well, you can go if you have chaperones. Well, Veronica's aunt and uncle were going to the dance. Therefore, we had chaperones, and we went. And it was, a nice dinner dance. We had a good time. At this time, I didn't really realize that Oscar was 8 years older than I was. You know, when you're 15 and someone's 23, that's quite a stretch. But my father liked Oscar. He liked to talk history, and Oscar loved history. And so if we went out, my parents always wanted the young man to come and have dinner with us, and it was nice, and they got to talking a lot. Well, anyway, we dated just a few times in the spring, and then he told me one night, he said, you know, there's something called the GI Bill. Now, Oscar had come to this country to earn enough, he was going to come for 2 years and earn enough money to go back to Germany and buy some land. But he got to liking it here, and had nothing to do with me at that time, but he heard about the GI Bill. And he realized that he could get a college education if he were to go into the Army and follow through. So he told me, he said, I'm going to go into the Army, I'll be away for 2 years. And, I said, well, I'll miss you.
Right.
But he did that, and he served for a year in outside of Washington at Fort Belvoir. And then he was transferred to Germany for the second year. He was a company clerk, and because he was bilingual, he would be the one who would go downtown to investigate a knifing or whatever, mm-hmm. and translate and put it into proper English. So for a young man who spoke English but hesitantly when he left, when he came back, oh my God, he could speak English better than I could, you know. The Army had done wonderful things for him. I mean, and he had done wonderful things with them. So I went to Cornell, and in the fall of 55, and he came in the spring of 56 as a special student, and special because the only grades he had were from the American Army. Any records, during the war, schools fell apart and everything, and he didn't have any records from them there. So they said, well, if you can do the work, you can stay. And he did the work, and he became an engineer. And I graduated in 59, and we got married the following December. And it was the start of a very exciting life. We moved down to New Canaan for 6 months, and his boss wanted him to move into the city, and I told Oscar, I said, I don't think you can deal living in the city, and I know I can't. So,
who did you work for?
Well, it was called Thorough Wagon Works. It was a company that made truck bodies and that kind of thing. And very nice people. It was a really good job. To turn it down, you're young, you don't think about those things. It was a big step. But my father said we could come back here, and there was a little house next door. We could live there and start our own business.
Is the house still there?
No, because when we sold to the Faith Church, everything except for the brick house is there.
Right.
But not, there was a little house next door, and then there was another house that my father had built to rental out in the field, and then we had built a house up on the hill next to Rog Manufacturing. Mm-hmm. But when we sold to Faith Church, they they wanted it all. And I told them, I said, but you can't touch the brick house because it's a historic landmark. And I said, the boards and commissions will never leave you alone if you touch it. So fortunately, that has remained. They took down the little smokehouse behind. And it was a lovely, it was a square structure about maybe 5 foot wide, and had a little peak roof with shingles on it, little holes along the side, and it was where you smoked meats. And we smoked hams and bacons in there. Oscar would get apple wood and you know, make a fire and smoke it. And to put your head in there and smell that combination of smoke and the hams and bacons that had been smoked have a particularly wonderful aroma. We did that for a couple of years. But unfortunately, the church required more land, and so kind of the smokehouse wasn't part of the house. I never thought to put it on, even right. though it should have been. So if you wanted a septic system, you had to knock down the smokehouse. Right. I had wanted to take it to Virginia when I went, but there was no way that there was time to do it. So anyway, that's sad, that's lost. But the house is there, and
what's this, there's a significance to that house, right? I mean, besides the age of it.
That's right, it's the old noble house. And it, I think that there were, that they were Tories. I don't know the history, but I do know that there was an English, English medallion over the front door, and an English eagle, I think it was. So my father promptly went and put a American Eagle brass door knocker on, you know, so it was balanced out. Anyway, the everything in that house came locally except for the glass. The glass was shipped in from England. It has that wonderful wavy effect. You know?
Absolutely.
And we were very careful, and most of it is still there. The wood came, you know, from the mountains. The granite was hauled over from Roxbury with oxen, mm-hmm. and brought to the front door of the kitchen, and then the oxen would go around and be hitched up to the back door, and they pull the granite through into the for the fireplace. And the front doorstep, the front porch, and the back porch were granite from Roxbury. And the bricks were made locally, and the metalwork came from Brookfield Ironworks. And the Brookfield Ironworks made the part of the chain which went across the Hudson River to keep out the British. And I thought that was a very interesting bit of history. And it was a wonderful house. It'll always be part of me.
It's amazing how buildings can just really, you can identify with them so personally.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I was married in the house, or at least we had our reception there. My grandmother died there. My brother was born there in the back room. My father said, when you have those three things happen, then your house is really, really and truly a home. And it's a Georgian colonial, has tall ceilings, wonderful woodwork around the windows and the baseboard and across whatever they call it, between the ceiling and the wall. And always painted white. And which set off, of course, the colors of the different rooms. The kitchen had a great big fireplace in it, which was probably 5 foot across and maybe four or 5 foot high, with a Dutch oven on one side. And then another, below the Dutch oven, which had lovely brickwork, by the way, underneath that was a place, well, we used to put firewood there, but they say that in the wintertime, when there was a small child, that they would put them in this compartment so the warmth from fireplace would keep them warm. And to back up that, when I was six or seven, for Christmas time, we used to go down to Danbury to, I don't know, McCrory's or a couple of the $0.10, at least so I could Christmas shop. And I remember I had $5, which was back in those days, big sum for me anyway, and bought the different Christmas presents and saved $0.50 out for a goldfish and a goldfish bowl. And I brought it home and set it up in my room. And the first night was fine, but the second night, the goldfish and the bowl froze. That's how little heat we had in the house back in those days. We had just a furnace for one room and a pot-bellied stove in the kitchen. And my room was above that, but even the heat wasn't enough. Mother said that the plates used to freeze on the shelves and things, you know. It took us a couple of years before we got, oil heat. Oh, I can't believe how wonderful it was to have oil heat. And that was just downstairs. Upstairs, it took us another couple of years before we got that. But the being there in that valley and it was just a few cars going by on the road. In fact, Mother used to say every once in a while, well, if I pest her, she will go out and count the cars. You know? And we had our cows. The barn was on the same side of the house, same side of the road as the house. And so every day we would take our cattle across the street for like night pasture. And it was my job to, drive the cows, and my father would stand at the head of the lane and wait for, the road to get empty. We'd go across. And that worked well for a number of years until the traffic got so heavy. And even with lanterns and flags, people got where they finally just would just go through, or drive right through the cattle. It was some of our neighbors in New York State. And the mother told one funny story about a guy in a big Cadillac, chauffeur driven, stopped just past where we crossed the cows, got out, got a little shovel out of the trunk, scooped up the manure, put it in a bag, put it in the trunk, got back in and took off again. Mother always thought that was, very fun.
Do you feel like there is animosity towards people from New York?
I suppose, I don't know, but I always thought that if you don't stop for people's cattle and everything, it got so bad finally that in 58, my father sold a dairy herd. Now this herd had started with 9 cows, which were of various different breeds, but he chose Holsteins, and he had a herd of about 35 or 40. And, agriculture judges its farmers and everything. And he had the third best herd in New England.
Oh, wow.
And I remember Abraham Ribicoff gave him part of a ceremony, a silver pitcher, everything. But after that, we sold and we went over to beef, because the beef you didn't have to take back and forth across the road. And we bought a second farm, which was Meadowbrook. Now Meadowbrook, I suppose there's about 120 acres up there. It's a housing development up on Second Hill.
Okay.
Back then it was just a farm, but we farmed up there for until 1968. And my father wanted us to buy a nearby farm, and we were starting our business. We didn't have the money to do that. And so one day we were sitting in the kitchen, a very fateful day, and Oscar was reading the Wall Street Journal, and we were sitting around the table and talking about getting more farmland. And Oscar's looking like this, he said, well, before you buy some of that really expensive land, he said, here's some land in Virginia. And he says, it's nowhere as near as expensive as what was over there in toward Bridgewater area. The next week, I can't believe it, my father got in the car and he drove. This was in probably, I would say August or September. He drove to Virginia. Southwest Virginia, over like past Roanoke, about 3/4 hour past Roanoke. And it was definitely agricultural country, beautiful. It was Shenandoah Valley. And he didn't buy from that first ad that Oscar saw, but he went around and checked out a couple of different farms, and he found it. And oh my God, by November, he had bought it. And I remember he had a man go down there. We had a farm helper, and each week the helper would take a load of furniture or farm equipment or whatever. I think that there were 17 or 18 loads, and that didn't even include the cattle. They must have had a cattle truck, though I wasn't there when that happened. And suddenly, my family was split. Oscar and I were here with our children, and my father and mother and sister and two brothers were 13 hours away. And I'd come back to Milford partly because I wanted to be close to family. And here we are, so very shortly after my father moved down there, he knew that Oscar was interested in agriculture and everything. And there was a farm close by down there in Tazewell, and he put a down payment on it for Oscar. And he said, and it's amazing, land values. Back in 68, you could get a 600-acre farm for $50,000, including a house. Now, the house needed some redoing and everything, and had some barns. So Oscar thought about it, and he said, I think we'll buy it, Of course, we couldn't move down there because we had our business. We had rug manufacturing here. But we had a young man who managed the place, and we raised cattle, cow-calf operation. And we did that for 68 till 85. And Oscar had always been looking for some more land. And we saw a beautiful place. We always passed it on 81, which was the major highway. And we saw it was for sale. And for a lot less than it had been advertised, so we took a big step and bought the place there. And we had a customer here, but the real estate market tanked. So we lost that customer, and it took us until 2001 to be able to sell. And the one thing about a church is you can't zone out a church. And so once that happened, and they wanted that land, we sold it to them, and we moved. Now, we had been going back and forth a lot, and I had been, every trip we had a van, and every trip we went, the van was loaded with stuff. I don't know, I guess it was just instinctual, but this was Oscar's dream, and it was very, very important to him, and I was determined that he was going to get there. And so we sold the land in November of 2001, and we left on December 21st, 2001, and went to Virginia. And it was a momentous move, Now, Oscar had Parkinson's disease, and he'd had it for 18 years. But fortunately, good medicines. And he was out on that farm every day. He knew that farm the way a otter knows a stream or a ferret knows the fields. And he just reveled in it. And we raised hay and we raised cattle for a bit. But then the man that we had left, and we had to sell the cattle and just continue to raise hay and improve the land and everything. And he unfortunately died in 2008. And I knew I wouldn't be able to run the farm. So, and my children were all in the Northeast. So the only place I knew was New Milford, and that's why I came back to New Milford. I knew the roads, and I'm not the great adventurer. So I knew where I was, kind of safe and sound here, and I came back early in 2009, and been here ever since. So so now we were talking before about the valley. This town was definitely an agricultural town back in 1941. And
was tobacco very big at that point then? Or had that
interesting
passed?
We had the tobacco barns, and I guess some people did it. My father tried, and he said it was like dealing with poison ivy. His skin could not take it. So but I think Joe Baskey had some. But it was turning to dairy and that sort of thing. But there were tobacco barns all, you know, probably four or five of them between our house and New Milford. And they were wonderful. I mean, they held a lot of hay. That was the original idea. You put the hay in them. And when we first started farming, we only had horses for the first 2 years. I can remember one time. Mother would be pitching the hay onto the wagon, my father driving the horses, and I was running along behind. And the horses ran over a yellow jacket's nest. And by the time I got to where the yellow jacket's nest was, they were ready for me. And I don't know why I wasn't killed at that point. I was covered with yellow jackets. And mother rushed me next door to a neighbor, and they put ammonia, which counteracts it, on. But I've never liked yellow jackets ever since. But the trying to get the hay, the load of hay to the barn before the storm, it was always, you know, you're racing those horses and everything. We got tractors, I think, maybe three. We got a tractor, 4-power to blow the silage up into the silo. Mm-hmm. And it was great, big, heavy-duty tractor. And then later on, we got some more. But it was definitely agricultural. We had one major business, which was the bleachery. And they took, you know, cloth and, I guess, dyed it and bleached it and sold it. I didn't know much about it. But those were the early days. Now, later on, you've got a lot more people living here, people who suddenly realized they could live in the country, but, you know, get to Stanford or to New York or to the airports in an hour and a half.
What was that like, having all those people all of a sudden just start?
Well, I suppose it affected us traffic-wise. I don't know. You know, it's a gradual thing. It wasn't like
right.
Suddenly
no, absolutely.
Flood. It's a gradual thing. And in Milford, it was a big town.
Yeah.
And I knew what the map in Milford looked like. Our life was spent on the south end of town with trips to the center of town, but never to the north of town.
It strikes me how, not to interrupt you, but just it strikes me how sort of insular the villages in New Milford are.
That's
I mean,
right.
we really, like, I consider myself, I grew up in Mariel. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't grow up in New Milford, I grew up in Mariel.
That's right. And of course, at school, it was a little country school down there, one room school. I can't remember what road it was on, but of course, then when they built Main Street School, everybody came into the center of town. So, and I've heard, I never went to that one room school, but I've heard that, you know, people got well educated there. It's just that, you know, it's just, we had a farm truck. It took us a while to get a car. You know, mm-hmm. It was hard then to make money from agriculture. It's hard today to make money from agriculture.
Right.
So, you know, you did the best you could. And, but it was, it has, all the stores and things which are along Route 7 now, they weren't there. And there were some really good stores in town. You could go to Golden's, and you wouldn't buy a tuxedo there, but you could get a very nice tweed jacket, and you would be dressed just fine if you were going to the city. Had nice women's clothes. The Golden Brothers were very, very nice. Barton's was there. There were three or four. That was geared, I think, more to women and kind of a department store. There were two or three. Mr. Greenhouse had a shoe store, and there were two or three other shoe stores. You didn't have to go to the mall to get dressed.
Right.
And even the mall is lacking in some, you know,
yeah.
some ways. So, and then there was, my father liked horses very much. And, of course, Green's Warehouse down mm-hmm. there by the railroad a track.
They had the horse out front, right?
The white horse out front, which I guess is part of Historical Society.
It was lost for years. They found it in someone's basement.
You're kidding.
No.
Really? Well, anyway, going in there, Perry Green, such a nice man, he had a big coal stove, and which he kept going in any of the cooler and colder months, and with chairs sitting around. So people would come in and sit down and, you know, chat for a while. And then, of course, he had saddles and bridles and all those leathery kind of things, which there's a special smell about those. You know, my father loved that store, and he would make sure that he got there fairly often, you know. And he loved horses. He always had horses. Even in Virginia, he had probably 25 horses. I don't know. I think he just liked to see them out in the fields. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when he was born in 1910, in New York City, a lot of horses were being used to, you know, to take carriages around and the rest of it. So it's interesting how you can go from a horse-drawn society back in the early 1900s to the moon and to the stars. I mean, it's in 110 years.
Yeah.
And he remarked on that. You know, he says, I've seen it all. He had gone around the world once with some cousins and had wonderful stories to tell about that. And they came back. They must have gone east, and they came back from China and crossed the ocean. And then he got on the back of a train. And it was like a platform on the back, you know, a little railing around it, and sat out there a lot as they drove across America.
Oh my gosh.
I went to Europe and I saw a lot, but I cannot imagine going, you know, the full circumference. But it was he and a couple of cousins, and they had a tutor who was their chaperone and everything like that. And the guy knew some languages, and oh my God, the things that they saw, you know, and riding on the trains, you know, and just, it was, amazing world.
Yeah.
So,
do you have any memories of the flood of 55?
Yes, I do. came on fairly fast, and I remember the boy next door, my friend, his father, by this time, 55, I think we'd just gotten our licenses, you know, and his father had a Cadillac, and I remember going out and going up Route 7 to the Four Corners, and going in on, going up like you go to the right, past where the present fire station is, and you go around a corner toward Harrybrook, and they had, you know, fences up across the road, not fences, but barriers,
mm-hmm.
And on the level, we were okay on the level, but the water had come up to the level, and it was about, I think, maybe 14 or 15 feet down to, you go down the hill and around the curve, it was all water. You go south toward Brookfield, you were okay there, and you could go up Huckleberry Hill and down, heading down toward Caldors. Once you went down that side of the hill, it was all enclosed, I mean, with water, and it was terrible. Now, it didn't affect us on our farm particularly. You always expected flood mm-hmm. waters at certain times, and we had enough high, you know, high pastures and everything. But what it did to the county, my father was in the legislature at that time, and he went out with, I guess, a few days after after the flood, went out with other legislators and the governor of Connecticut to see what had happened to Litchfield County. And there is, in the newspaper, I've got it somewhere, a full page, all the pictures that they took and everything, several page count of the disaster. You know, if you're heading up toward Litchfield, it's a double lane bridge that is up. Oh dear, I can't remember. It's before you get to Bantam. anyway, that the old bridge was totally washed out. All the cottages along the Farmington River were washed out. And the Farmington River was a place on the way to Hartford. We used to go, before 84, we used to go the back way, over 202 and
118. And
yeah, go up that way. And I mean, and in Danbury, the flood was terrible. And it covered the first floors. And a lot, there was a lot of urban renewal because of it. And my father said it was a mixed bag because a lot of poor people lost their housing. And and of course, what they built, I don't think it was that great either. But anyway, I wrote a book a few years ago for my granddaughter called Boreas the Bear, and I think there's a copy here. And I write about that flood and as part of it, you know, because I wanted my grandchildren to know what it was like back in those days. So go pick it up and read it sometime. And I'd always thought it would be fun to have a small raft on the river, you know, because I spent a lot of time down there on a little bridge on the back road. And I got to thinking about it when I was writing the book and realized that if you're on a raft, you still have riverbanks, so you can't really see the fields. But then I remembered the flood and said to myself, okay, my characters are going to float on a raft during the flood and they can see out over the fields. It was just something I did, you know, just for fun.
Right.
But it was quite an experience. So, and I don't know whether it was that flood. We always had spring floods here, but there was one flood here in town at Southwest. Used to be the Cadillac dealership, and the flood came fast, and they drove all the cars as fast as they could up to like the high school parking lot up there. But there was one very, very expensive Cadillac, and there wasn't time. So they put it on the lift, and they put it up as high as they could, and then they had to leave. And they came back after the waters had receded, and the water had come up into the interior of the Cadillac, even in spite of the fact it was up probably 8 foot high. So it shows you what can happen. And when they were building the other two lanes on Route 7, they showed, the Department of Transportation showed Oscar the plans that they had for the where you go across the bridge, and there was like a rotary there. Now it's a T-shape.
Yeah.
And these wonderful plans. And he said, it's still going to flood. Oh, no, said the engineers. We have checked it out, and it is above any danger of flooding. And Oscar said, no, it isn't. And he knew what he was talking about because it still floods.
It's almost every year.
Almost every year. So, I'm sure the state didn't feel like paying more money to change their plan. So it's just one of those funny little historical bits. So... And of course, now with the new highway or the new lanes on the highway, it's really a speedway, and it's. I think that also has changed the town, and it. So those are kind of the memories. Unless you have some more questions.
I have two.
Okay.
One is selfish. One is not.
Yeah.
The first one is, so it strikes me that you sort of felt disconnected from, I guess, the community that was New Milford. I mean, but
probably didn't know it,
right?
You know, as a child, it's just simply you went to school, and
you were so far away.
And we, 5 miles isn't much when you think about it today, but back in those days, it wasn't anything you would walk,
right?
And there were really, you went into town for groceries, and you went into town for tractor parts. But life was busy on the farm, and now that I look back on it, yes, I was probably a rather solitary child, but I could walk any place in the swamps and up the mountain. I had my dog, and I knew where all the wild strawberries were, and I knew where some of the rare flowers were. And I think by the time I was 7 and a half, mother would let me go across the street by myself because there weren't that many cars.
Right.
And I was always taken by the beauty of the place, you mm-hmm. know. And it was my world. I didn't think about, you don't think about the fact that you perhaps are isolated.
Right.
And today, with things being as crowded as it is, I'm always glad for a little isolation,
yeah.
you know. I still have a little piece of mountain land left over from when we sold to the church. And, to walk up in there, it's lovely.
Yeah.
So
you told me a great story, and this is the selfish question.
Yeah.
You told me a great story about Robin Stack, about him
taking his
plot with him.
Yes. Robin Stack was a neighbor about a half mile north, maybe a quarter of a mile north of us. And his father had raised rather rare wildflowers. I mean, of course, he farmed, but wildflowers were his specialty. He also knew, I remember he came down and he repaired the window which was over our front door and re-glued the fret. There's a lovely fretwork which is there with ivy vines and everything. And he did that. Robin and Robin was his son. His mother was there. Robin had, I guess, a couple of sisters. I didn't know them very well. But anyway, we were never close friends. It was just a neighbor, you know. Anyway, he lived there for a number of years. And, of course, the highway here I don't know when the highway came through.
Mid-2000s, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And his land was going to be taken. And I think they had another home up in Marial. And so he agreed to sell his land to the state, provided that they allow him to take the topsoil from his garden. And I think he took 23 or 24, the story that I heard was 23 or 24 truckloads of this wonderful topsoil up to Marial. I suspect up there it was a little rockier, and so he brought his garden patch up there. And when I say patch, I'm not demeaning, it's just his garden space, because farming was, important to him. And the soil in that valley was wonderful, sandy loam, and you could dig in it. Well, it was very rich, and I am sure that they fertilized it and they nourished that soil. I mean, my father did too, but when you're doing it for cattle, of course, the cattle spread the manure around.
Right.
You don't. It's not as intensive, but that little garden plot was, was intensive. So it. Now, when I went to Virginia, and I thought, I had a big garden down here when I lived next to the brick house and in the brick house, and I thought, well, I'm going to garden down there. And I remember taking a trowel, and going to stab the earth, and darn near broke my shoulder. Because it was clay soil, and I mean, digging in clay soil, you almost need to have an electric power drill. And I had never dealt with clay soil before because we'd always had sandy loam. So when I did flower beds, my Oscar had to come and use a rototill and things like that, and we had to put on a lot of top dressing before we could get the soil which right. So anyway, it's just interesting, how I believe, and I've heard that our valley was a river valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it finally broke through at Harry Brook and went down the Housatonic. But the silt and sand and the gravel which were in that valley were placed there by a river which was running through.
Right.
And Still River ran north. And north running rivers are very unusual. The Nile runs north, and the river down in Virginia, very close to us, was a north running river. But most rivers run in the other three directions. So when I was small, Still River was very, very dirty. And my grandfather, who was a doctor, took a water test one time, and he said that was as dirty as along the Hudson River where the sewer outlets were. We were not to put our hands into it. And it was true. You could see the dyes, you know, the dyes from the Danbury hat factories. So some days the water would be red, some days it would be bluish, and the rest of it, you couldn't see to the bottom of the water. The only thing, which were, there were turtles, no fish or anything like that. There was a certain amount of quicksand in that river, so if you had to go across, and that wasn't me, but you know, people driving the cattle. The cattle had found a place where the bottom was sound, and they would go across that. And the river was dirty for years and years. My father went as a legislator up to Boston when I was 7 or 8 to the first Clean Water Conference. It was a chance for me to see Boston. You know, that was exciting, but he was interested in clean water. Now, he didn't, he had many other things to do, so he didn't pursue it, but other people were, you know, pursuing it. And one of the very funny things is, you know, Brookfield was asked several times if people were using septic systems or dumping it into the river. And, everybody's got a septic, it's all safe. Well, one August, the river always was smelly in August, but one August we had a terrible drought, and lo and behold, you could see all these drains go from houses going into the river. So then they had really had to clean. They had to clean up, and now, interestingly enough, the water is clear enough you can see to the sand on the bottom, which is amazing to me. Yeah. And there are fish living in the river. So a lot of good work was done to restore, you know, to restore that river.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful bridge that went across it, which I spent lots of hours when I was young, you know, dropping sticks on one side and watching them go through the other side. Of course, the cattle would go across. Unfortunately, neither New Milford nor Brookfield were going to repair it. So now it's down to like a very narrow, like narrow boards going across the middle, and it's blocked off. No traffic can go across it. And the land we, when we left, we gave that little piece of land to Weatnog. So now Weatnog owns the, you know, that whole stretch in there. So
this has been great. I mean, this is exactly. I really appreciate it. If you have any other thoughts, that's
well, I you know, it's just. You know, we have five wonderful children. They're all married. I have 11 grandchildren. Most of them live in the Northeast. My oldest son lives in Atlanta, works in a New York bank. So he commutes every Monday morning and goes home every Friday night. I don't get as much chance to see him, but the other ones are one's in New York, one's in south of Boston, and there's two daughters in Connecticut, so I get to see them, you know, fairly often. We had our business here. It was, I think, a good business, but there came a time when it was time to, you know, close it down and move on. So it, I don't know. It's a funny thing. I remember when, I think it was my youngest was born, and all my children were born in the Milford Hospital. And I remember one evening, you know, back in those days, you stayed for 3 or 4 days, coming out and standing in, it was like a solarium in the front of the hospital up on the third floor, and looking out over the town and saying to myself, you know, this really is my town. And it's funny, you have these little flashes of memory, and it's where I've come back to, and it is my town, and it's changed somewhat in the rest of it, but of course, I'm on my own now, but it's a good town and good people, and hopefully it will have even a better future.
Thank you so much.
Okay.